Excuse me, I was just getting ready for the initiation ceremony at the temple. Let me turn this down here. Excuse me. Here we go. Okay, we're ready. We're ready. Yes, we're ready. Students, you are ready. You are now ready to enter the inner sanctum, the core, the very heart of dividend discount models. By examining the sacred discounted cash flow model. And you too will be initiated. You will be a risen investment guru. So let's get started on slide 35. The discounted cash flow model is perhaps the most famous and certainly my favorite version of the dividend discount models. It uses the present value of the expected dividends and the present value of the expected future price to value a share of stock. So the formula looks something like this. A value of the stock is equal to the present value of future dividends. So we do those calculations. And then we take the present value of the price of the stock when we plan to sell, or our time horizon. We use the present value multipliers from the table, so I suggest that you print a copy of them out because you're going to be using them for the rest of the semester. You can have them on the screen, but I think it's better to have a copy in your hand. It's not specifically covered in the textbook, which I think is very unfortunate. It's really just the pure form of the dividend discount model that we looked at the very beginning of the second presentation, the previous presentation. But instead of having three dividends and then promptly going out of business, we assume that the company's still going to be worth something. The stock is still going to be worth something. And as I said, it's my favorite dividend discount model. And as with all the other dividend discount models, this model is very sensitive to our estimates and our choice of required rate of return, and hence can be very far off the mark. No, dear students, not can be, will be. We don't actually believe that this expected value that we give, that the perceived value that we give the stock is really what it's worth. All we are doing is tilting the odds in our favor so that we choose companies that have done well in the past and should continue to do well in the future. And if we make those our core holdings, then sure, go out and buy something that might turn your $1,000 into $50,000 or 50 cents. But that will be the spice. That will be your Vegas money. Yeah, that's what I used to call my fund that I put these very hot stocks in, my Vegas fund, and it lived down to its name. So let's get started. Slide 36. Now it's working. Example number one. Let's assume it is January 1st, 2019. Pretzels Unlimited is currently selling for $22 per share and will pay $2 per share in dividends in 2019. At least that's what they're saying they're going to pay. Remember, any quarter, they can stop. PU expects to increase their dividends to $2.20 in 2020, $2.30 in 2021, and $2.30 in 2022. We will be selling the stock at the end of 2022, and we expect the price to be $27 per share at that time. Our expected, our required, our desired rate of return is 12%. So, again, the formula, the value of the stock is equal to the present value of the future dividends and the present value of the price of the stock when we plan to sell, or, in other words, our time horizon, 3-4 years. So, how do we do this? Well, remember, if you remember the dividend discount model, the purest form that we looked at in the previous presentation, we take the money we're going to receive in year number one, that's $2, And then we multiply it times the present value multiplier for year number one. Well, let's bop on over to the present value table. We go across to 12% in year number one, 0.83893. And let's grab the second one too, just to make life a little bit easier, 0.9797. So you see we have $2 in the first year times 0.893, and then in year number two, $2.20 times the present value multiplier for year number two, 0.979. Now for year number three and four, the dividends are going to be we don't know this, we're just estimating them, $2.30 in year number three and $2.30 in year number four. So let's go grab the present value multipliers for year number three, 0.712, and year number four, 0.636, and bring them back over here. So $2.30 times 0.712 and $2.30 times 0.636. The second part of the formula, the present value of the price of the stock when we plan to sell, we believe, we're estimating, we guess, we may look at somebody else's estimate and say, we think it's going to be worth $27 at the end of year number four. So what's the present value multiplier for year number four? Don't get caught in the trap. What some students do is they go use the present value multiplier for year number five. No, it's the same year, 0.636. And we're going to change the presentation. We're going to change the structure of the problem so that we don't get bit by that problem, by that common error. So we take the $27 times 0.636. Now, I did those calculations for you. You can do them to make sure that I did them correctly. And you don't need all this precision, folks. You really don't need it. Don't bother. You can write all the numbers down or use a spreadsheet or a calculator, but the rounding is fine. And so we wind up with $23 approximately and 81 cents. Now, what does this number represent? It represents what we believe the stock is worth based on the present value of the future cash flows. We're going to get some dividends in years 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then at the end of year number 4, we think we're going to sell the stock. We don't have to, but we're thinking it's going to be worth $27, so we could sell it. And that future cash flow stream brought back to the present is equal to $23.81. So if our required rate of return is 12%, this is a pretty good stock to buy. You make sense? I know the calculations are so much easier than what you're actually doing. You're going, what am I doing? I don't understand. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about whether or not you understand exactly what you're doing. Just do the calculations. Keep doing them. Do them so many times that you see them in your dreams at night. And then the meaning will be like a flash, a brilliant flash of light in the middle of the night, like a lightning bolt. And you'll say, oh, I'm just taking the future cash flow that I'm getting in the future. Well, I hope to get in the future. Who knows what you're going to get. But I hope to get this cash flow in the future, and I'm bringing it back, and I'm assigning a value to it today. That's why we call it the present value. And we call the calculation discounting. I know it's a horrible term. I didn't design it. I didn't develop it. But we say we're discounting those future cash flows back to the present. Okay? So get used to it. Because when you meet up with fellow dividend discount model fans, that's the terminology they're going to use. Right? Okay, so get used to it. Now, slide number 36. As I said, we're going to change the structure of the problem just so that it makes it easier for us to do. I like to put them in table format. I think it makes a whole lot easier to understand and do the calculations. So 2019, 2020, 2021, 2022, here are our four dividends. And then 2022, we believe the stock will be worth $27. Here are the present values. Notice the last two are in year number four. And then you multiply. There might be a little multiply symbol here that make life a little easier, and a little equal sign right there. And here are the discounted cash flows. Add them up and you get about $23.81. Now, I think this is much easier to comprehend and calculate in this format, right? But we're going to do one better. Watch what happens when on slide number 38 we combine the addition of the final dividend and the price of the stock. So look at slide 38. If you're listening to this, you're going to want to, in your car or whatever, when you get home, get to wherever you go, you want to take a look at slide 38. So this is the final version for us to do. And this is what I will always do in the worksheets and on the answer keys, and what I suggest you do, because it just makes life so much easier. Adding the dividend and the stock price in the last year saves us a couple of manual calculations, but more importantly, it allows us to use a very special spreadsheet function to calculate internal rate of return. Oh my goodness, slide 39, where are we? Dear students, you have now been introduced to a concept that you normally don't get in until you get to an upper level or graduate finance or investment class. But really, it's not that hard. Why? Because the spreadsheet does it for us. Let's go back to slide 38. If we just simply enter the numbers like this into our spreadsheet, and we're going to see a spreadsheet, then the spreadsheet does all the calculations for us. Isn't that wonderful? Internal rate of return on slide 39 is a measure of what rate of return we expect to get from a series of cash flows. But we have to include the positive and the negative cash flows. Huh? Hang on, it's not that hard. You'll see. Someday, when you take an upper level or graduate level finance or investment class, you will learn how to manually compute internal rate of return. And hopefully you will not have a sadistic professor who will require you to calculate it manually more than once. Because it's not that hard. It just takes a long time. It's a very tedious you have to do one calculation and then, okay, try another calculation and then try another calculation, and it just takes forever. But that's why we have computers, right? The computers can do the calculation like that. So we're simply going to enter the numbers into our spreadsheet and press the return key, okay? In other words, we required a 12% rate of return from Pretzels Unlimited. The internal rate of return function will tell us what we're actually going to get, or what we expect to get, right? What we're proposing to get. And that's why it is so cool. Slide 40. Here is the spreadsheet, and it's meant to look like a spreadsheet. It's really just a table in the presentation manager here. But we'll show you the spreadsheet. Just relax, relax. Okay. The spreadsheet formula is equal sign IRR. That stands for internal rate of return. Aren't these spreadsheet folks kind of tricky? And then you open the parentheses, and then you put the block of cells. Now, the block of cells must contain any negative cash flows. In other words, what did you have to pay for this investment? Right? You had to pay something for it. And then come the cash flows. So here. And then the second part, you can just leave it blank. You can leave it zero. Or you can put in what you think it's going to be. You know, I think it's going to be 12%. I think it's going to be 10%. You can leave it zero, and the spreadsheet will try to do it on its own. But you're helping it if you give it an approximate guess. So here's what your spreadsheet will look like. And we'll look at it in just a minute. Just relax. We have to put year zero, you know, today, what we paid for the stock. Our initial outlay is $22. So you enter any outflows as negative numbers. Then come our year 2019, year 2020, 2021, and 2022, $2 dividend, $2 dividend, $2.30 dividend, and then in year number four, 2022, we expect to get a $2.30 dividend plus $27 proceeds, because the stock, that's what we believe it's going to look like. And then we make the formula in this cell right here, and assuming that this is A column, B column, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, then it would be internal rate of return, B2 to B5, that's what the B2 colon B5, comma, and then I entered, as I said, 12%, what I thought we were going to get. It turns out the internal rate of return tells us we're getting 14.51%. What could be easier? You see, you don't understand what the hell you're doing, but look how easy it is to do. But relax. As I mentioned, it's going to come to you over time. And some of you already got it. You're saying, Piano, stop reaching to me. But it's so true that many students just, they still get hung up on the words and they don't understand what the concept is. And that's okay. It is a little tricky because you're, normally we think about what's going to happen today and going into the future. Now we're doing it backwards. We're looking into the future and coming back today. So it's not something we're normally used to doing. You understand? I think you do. So now let's take a look at the example spreadsheet, which is on the class webpage and in Canvas. Okay? Okay, here it is. Here it is. Now it's in Excel format here. There's a reason for that. But when you go download it from the class website or from Canvas, it goes into Google Docs, and then Google Docs you can download it as Excel. So it's either one. They work exactly the same. So let's take a look here. This is the problem as we structured it at the very last iteration. You put in the years. Actually, you only have to put in the 1 year. It adds up the years as it goes along. And then you put in the cash flows, $2 for the first year, $2.20 for the second year, $2.30. The third year, and then $2.30 and $27. See that? Now, the present value multipliers, you don't have to type in. The system is kind of tricky. It knows, it's a spreadsheet, so it knows how to do this. Now, you can't see it. I'm going to have to move it over one more. You put in the required rate of return, and it recalculates the present value multipliers for you. You don't even need to worry about You don't even need to worry about using the present value tables because the spreadsheets are just so much cooler, but you're going to use them to begin with, right? And so then it does the present value of the cash flow. It does the multiplication. $2 times 0.893 is $1.786, so plus or minus something. And then it does the addition for you. Now, is that cool? Now, please, do them manually first at least 4 or 5 or 6 times until you're thoroughly disgusted with them. You've done them so many times. And then use the spreadsheet because we want you to understand what you're doing. Now, that was the problem as we did them in the presentation, and you're going to do them on the worksheets and on the assignments and on the exam number 2 and then on exam number 3 and then exam number 4 and the final exam. You're going to be doing these for the rest of the semester. Yes. So you might as well learn them, do them now. Contact me if you have any problems. That's why I'm alive. Now, you can't see it again because it's down at the bottom, but there's a second page where you click on internal rate of return in a spreadsheet, and here is the formula that we showed you in the previous slide here. You put in the initial outlay as a negative number because we had to pay that out. That's money that went out of our checkbook. And then you put in the cash flows that you believe you're going to get in years 1, 2, 3, 4, 3 to 5. You know, that's about as far as you want to go. And then it comes back. There's the formula. Internal rate of return, and actually this starts at C4 to C8. I put in again 12% as an approximate rate of return, and it came back and told me that 12.51 is the value. Now, internal rate of return is not fail-safe. It can screw up. You can give it numbers that it can't calculate. And there are situations that just don't make any sense for internal rate of return. And that's why learning how to do it is a bit of a tedious task, because very quickly, if you start pushing in numbers and doing the manual calculations, you'll go, oh, this is unsolvable. And the spreadsheet will do that a whole lot faster than you do. And there's, later on, we might have time to discuss internal rate of return in more detail. But it is something that you spend quite a bit of time on in the upper level, the finance and investment, graduate level finance and investment. So, but you're learning how to do it now because you are awesome. And because it's really not as hard as people make it out to be once you do it a few times. Okay? So play with this spreadsheet. And again, please do the manual calculations first, at least 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 times until you feel you can do them in your sleep. And then go ahead and play with the spreadsheet. All right, so let's get the spreadsheet out of the way. Boonk. All right, now, let's continue. The discounted cash flow model, example number 2. Genes Are Us, it's a San Diego startup, biotech startup, is currently selling for $21 per share. It pays no dividend. We believe that Gruss will sell for around $50 per share in 5 years. Our required rate of return is 13%. How can we determine if this is a potentially good investment? Well, with no dividends, what model can we use? These are called dividend discount models, so you don't have any dividends. Wait a minute, we can still use the discounted cash flow model. How? Well, remember, the formula is equal to the value of the stock equal to the present value of future dividends plus the present value of the price of the stock when you plan to sell. Well, what's the present value of zero dividends? Zero, folks, because zero times anything is zero. So we're not getting any value from the dividends. Well, they don't pay dividends. But we believe the stock is going to be worth $50 in 5 years. So that's a future cash flow. And we can discount that cash flow. We can bring that $50 in 5 years back to our time right now, back to the present, by using the discounting calculation, the present value calculation. So what do we need to do? We need to go to the present value table for 13% for 5 years. So there's the years, and here's the 13%, 0.543. See that, folks? So we multiply the $50 times 0.543, and that tells us that we perceive the stock to be worth $27.13. So unlike the other dividend discount models, the discounted cash flow model can still be useful if there are no dividends. Very cool. But, dear students, now, maybe, hopefully, you are starting to see what I've been telling you from the very beginning, that some stocks are investments and some stocks are very speculative. What can we say about Genes or Us? It doesn't pay any dividends. It doesn't even have a biotech product out. It's losing money, vast sums of money, because it costs $400, $500, $600 million to get a drug out to market these days. Sure, it could be worth $50, it could be worth $500 in 5 years, or it could be worth 50 cents. And I got to tell you, folks, full disclosure here, these were the kind of companies that I was suckers for. I would go to the annual meetings, I would talk to the employees here in San Diego, because this is where our hotbed of biotechnology is. And these companies had awesome technologies, and some of them, they were going to change the world. Well, it didn't actually turn out that way. And they all started off pretty darn good and all ended pretty badly. That's why I told you my Vegas fun lived down to its name. So for everyone, Genes or Us, we want to have a ton of Pretzels Unlimited and 3M's and McDonald's and Exxon Mobil's and Home Depot's, and now Microsoft is a dividend paying stock that's been raising their dividends tremendously over years. And Philip Morris, Altria. So do you understand the difference now? Some stocks are prudent long-term investments. And I'm not telling you to buy these stocks, but I'm not telling you that these are the stocks you should buy. I'm telling you these are the stocks you should research and know as much as you can about and listen to the earnings calls and read every article you can find and download their annual reports and go to a place where we will discuss in a few slides that tells you what they think the dividends are going to be over the next few years and what the stock price is going to be worth. Make sense? Okay, I sort of tipped my hand here a bit. Slide number 42. The residual income model, similar to the constant perpetual growth model, but instead uses earnings in place of dividends. It allows us also to value a company as not paying dividends. The free cash flow model, which takes the residual income model one step further by taking into account non-cash expense items such as depreciation. And you know what, folks? These are basically they're variations on the themes that we have already looked at. So we'll skip these for now. Maybe come back to them later, okay? But remember, I told you that we are just learning a few of these models, and you have an entire lifetime to practice and play with others and find which ones that work for you, okay? And you'll find that many of them, they give similar results, and when they don't give similar results, often there's a reason. You could say, I understand why. You see, they're very subtle, and you play with them. That's why we, for the rest of the semester, are going to be playing with this discounted cash flow model and the constant perpetual growth model. Because if you can learn how to, if you master these models, you can learn and use the others and decide which ones are best for you. Plus, we haven't even gotten to ratio analysis, so relax, we'll get there. Slide 43. Okay, Piano, this is all great, but just where are we supposed to get all this historical information anyway? And just who decides what next year's earnings per share, sales per share, cash flow per share, dividends per share, etc. are going to be? Let alone the expected price of the stock in 3 to 5 years, huh? Well, before the internet, should we call that BI, the information was not readily available. Normally, you would ask your broker for it, or you would go to the library and use one of the securities industry's trusted information sources, or maybe you had your own subscription. And traditionally, the most respected source was, and in my humble opinion still is, the Value Line. Slide 44. Still one of the most respected, trusted sources of data and analysis. Folks, traditionally it was often the only source that many investors used for data and analysis. This is way before the internet, folks. I'm talking way before. Along with the company's materials, of course, you wouldn't download it. They didn't have an internet. You would contact the company. They would send you their annual report. And then you might go to the library. Hopefully you went to the library and you looked up Barron's and Wall Street Week and Investor's Business Daily and Kiplinger's and all the sources that have been around for decades. It's expensive. It's about $600 per year, $50 a month, but it can be obtained for free at various libraries. Southwestern has the cheapy version, the 600 stocks, but that's all we need for this class. If you go to a library that has one, and there's a link on the class website, and I think in Canvas too, that gives you the names of San Diego libraries that have it. Last time I checked, Chula Vista's main library had it. It's huge. There's almost 3,000 stocks that they cover. And those are just the large cap stocks. There are, and they're not all large cap, but they're mostly the big companies. Then they have about a few thousand more small and medium stocks. That's a different version. You don't get that with the $50 a month subscription. But you don't want the small one. Go to the library. I'm a big fan of Valueline, folks. I never buy a stock other than the goofball biotech companies that I looked at when I was in my youth in here in San Diego. I never buy a stock without consulting the Valueline. One study which ignored transaction costs and tax consequences only used their timeliness indicator. It showed how you would have beaten the market handsomely over a 20-year period by just buying and selling stocks as they received and then subsequently lost their number one timeliness designation. So in your book, if you got the book, or just go to the library, I want you to go to the library, you're going to pick up this sheet. It's a single sheet for each stock, and it's like a sip from the fire hose, folks. I mean, it's just, they just throw so much data at you, and you have to take your time to learn to see what's the important for you, but read their analysis, look at, you know, the growth trajectories of the cash flow and the earnings and the sales and the dividends and all the balance sheet issues, a tiny little, but we'll talk about balance sheets in the next presentation. So can you find the indicators? Can you find the future price projections? Very important. The historical data, the assets, the cash, the receivables, inventories, the description, analysis of the business, the historical annual rates, the insider institutional buying and selling, the amount of debt, the number of shares outstanding, the company's financial strength, stability, price growth, and earnings predictability ratings. Oh, my goodness. Now, here's the McGraw-Hill value line from the 6th edition. And if you go to the library and look up McGraw-Hill, you won't find it anymore. Why? Because they split in two. And they're no longer one company. So now I think they had, who did they have in the 7th edition? Oh, darn, I forgot. I forgot who they put in. I have to go back and look. But they switched to another, I think they did Pfizer, right? They did Pfizer. Excuse me. But here's the top page of the McGraw-Hill in the 6th edition. And this was what? This is 2010 or so. And here is the stock performance. This tells you there was a recession in 2001, and they don't show the recession in 2007 and 8. I don't know why they don't show that. But here's what happened to the price in 2008 and 9. Oh, boy, did it get clobbered. And then here's the sales per share, cash flow per share, earnings per share, dividends declared per share. And this is the... So here, you can see the growth, or lack thereof. And then what do? They say, you know what? In 3, 4, 5 years, we think the price is going to be anywhere between, what is that? I can't even read it. My apologies. I'm getting old. $48 and, say, $70. You see, they're not telling you a single number, but they're saying, we think this is what's going to happen in a few years. And this is what we think their sales per share, or their cash flow per share, their dividends per share. So do you see now why we take that 3, 4, 5 year time horizon? And back in chapter 4, when we were discussing mutual funds, I said I like mutual funds that have a 3, 4, 5 year turnover. They hold the stock for about 3, 4, 5 years. Why? Because that's about as far into the future as you can reasonably see. After that, it gets really, really murky. But if you keep your time horizon about 3, 4, or 5 years and continually redo these dividend discount models, you can say, you know what, the next 3 years I'm probably going to get 5, 6, 7%, maybe 7, 8, 9%, knowing that in any 1 year there could be a kerfuffle and it'll all fall down and you get back up again. Don't that's the time to buy more, right? But assuming things bounce along grumpily as they normally do, this is what we can reasonably expect. You see that? That's why I love mutual funds that have that 3, 4, 5 year time horizon, because they're doing this continually. They're doing exactly the same things that we're teaching you to do. Now, they may have far more versions that we do, and they have usually far more resources. Well, not usually. They have tons more resources. They have people on the ground all around the world, banging on doors, looking at the suppliers and the customers and their competitors. That's why I like mutual funds, because you know, I'm here in San Diego. But still, when you go into this world and start buying your own stocks, you need all the help you can get, and the Value Line is one of the best. Standard & Poor's also has theirs, but it's not very good. They used to give it to me for free, and I said, thank you very much. And, you know, it was free, but I still preferred the Value Line. Now, where's the time limits? Here's the time limits right here. See that one? That's the one we were talking about. They have this indicator called timeliness and safety and technical. I'm not sure exactly what that is. That's their technical indicator. We'll talk about technical indicators later on. But when they hit one, that means they think this is a good buy. This is a good buy. And then as soon as they go back to two or three, then they say, you know, it's okay. Three is okay. But as I said, that one study, if you bought, now that doesn't mean it's going to work in the future, but if you bought the stocks as they hit timeliness of one, and then sold as soon as they lost the timeliness, you did pretty darn well over decades. So let's now turn to the bottom part of the page. And here, you have to read this. I mean, obviously, you got to do more. The earnings call assignment. Listen to what the company says about themselves. Download their quarterly earnings, their annual report. But these people are paid to analyze these stocks. And as I said, they've done a pretty darn good job over decades. Cool? So, slide 48. Let's put Value Line to the test. In late 2009, the price of McGraw-Hill was $28.73. And their price prediction for early 2013 was in the range from $48 to $68. On February 15th, 2013, McGraw-Hill price closed at $45. Not too bad, huh? Actually, pretty darn good. When they made this prediction at the end of the 2009, the stock market had rallied from the depths of the 2008-2009 crisis, the bottom at March 9th, 2019. Many people were still predicting the end of the world. And you know what? Some of them are still predicting the end of the world. You know, someday the world's going to end. We know that to be true. We don't know when. I mean, obviously, within a billion and a half years, the place is going to be too hot. We got to leave by then, but that's a long way away. So let's take a look at the prediction from the, let's say, the fourth edition, okay? Well, here's the fourth edition. And the price was about $47, and they were expecting it to be anywhere between, say, 70 and 80 or so, 81 or 82. So why is it a lot more? Because they had split between this one and the one we just looked at. They split the stock, so you have to, you know, basically make the price half. Okay, so they're expecting it to be anywhere, you know, 70 so, 80 or so. Let's take a look. And then go ahead and read that if you want. How'd they do? Their price prediction for late 2009 was in the range from around $66 to $82. But the price was hovering around $24. Oh, I'm sorry. The split hadn't happened yet. It reached $70 in mid-2007 and started falling as the credit market started reacting to the home mortgage crisis. You see, they weren't the only ones. They did not see the result of the housing bubble. Yeah. So they were expecting it to be 66 to 82, and it was hovering around $24. Well, it reached $70. So they had hit their mark, you know, actually sooner than they thought. But the price started falling as the credit market started reacting to the home mortgage loan crisis. The old McGraw-Hill owned Standard & Poor's. You've heard of them, right? Standard & Poor's 500. These were the people who were issuing the AAA ratings on these home mortgages that were backed by lies. These were called liar loans. It plummeted. Their price plummeted as the home mortgage loan crisis spread to the entire financial sector. Their mid-2007 prediction from the fifth edition of the text was even uglier. But let's go back to the third edition. And here's where we have to take into account the split. I apologize. So they were saying, look. It's about $55 here. This is early 2003. And in 2005, 6, 7, we think it's going to be anywhere between 90 and 110 or so. And sure enough, the value line predicted that the price of McGraw-Hill would be about $90 to $110 in 2005 and 6. Why so much higher? It's because they split their stock 2-for-1. You have to divide these prices by 2 to compare them to the previous 2 predictions. Hooray for the value line! They were bang on the money. McGraw-Hill reached the 120 level by the end of 2006. Remember, split adjusted. I get a kick when some investors trash the value line. They call them fuddy-duddies, old-fashioned, too slow. You only get your updates to the value line every few weeks, and they don't update the whole thing, which is, folks, fine by me. I don't need to know what's going to happen in the next 2 or 3 days or 2 or 3 minutes. You know, the value line makes mistakes too, folks, just like everybody else. I'm not perfect, but I would sure love to see how those investors' long-term results stack up against the long-term results of the value line. Who do you think would have the better results? Well, yeah, check it out. Yeah, see what you think. And you know, as I said, I don't know if I told you, but this is my idea of a great time, right? My wife is a voracious historical novel reader, and I am a voracious investor, I guess you call me, a business reader, investigator. So we go to our local library, which happens to have the value line, on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday afternoon, and I bring my laptop, and she sorts through all these historical novels, and by the end of the day, she's got 5 or 6 to take home, and she'll read 2 within the week and maybe more. And then I'm sitting there by the value line, all 2,700 of them, and pulling out the leaflets and looking at them and typing in the numbers and saying, oh, this is cool, and then writing notes. And that's my idea of a hot afternoon. And I hope it's yours, too, eventually. Play. And the cool thing, as we said, you will never be able to learn everything there is to know about all these companies. It's not going to happen. You're only one person. And you can find the companies that you gravitate to and the industries that you feel comfortable with and specialize in them. And if you get involved in an investment club, you'll meet other people who will gravitate to other kind of companies, and they can do the research and bring it back to the club, and you can do the research for yours. Teamwork is a very valuable asset. And when I look at mutual funds, I look to see how much teamwork these companies use, because I love mutual fund companies that work as a team. They make their own decisions. They don't always have to agree, but they work as a team. So we bestow upon you the gift of researching using the price models from our first presentation, which not too excited about those, and then the dividend discount models from our second and third presentation, which are my favorite models. The bottom line. Okay. Now that we've done all this, right? Okay. Once you have finished all our valuation calculators, what should we do, right? Should we really place much value in our predictions? No. The answer is no. Emphatically. Italicized. Bold with an exclamation point. Rather, we should hurl them into the vast ocean along with the ashes of our dead pets and relatives. Shred them into millions of tiny little pieces and use them as confetti at our next party. Or burn them in a huge bonfire as we dance naked under the full moon. They are not to be believed. It is almost a certainty that your valuation is not going to be the right one. Maybe you'll hit it every once in a while. but rather we do these calculations to simply tilt the odds in our favor. Instead of placing any significance in our predictions, after we have finished, we should ignore them and ask ourselves a very simple question. Do I want to own this company? I mean, if I could come up with the $80 billion it would cost to buy this large cap company, Caterpillar, or whatever it is, I think it's like $67 billion, would I want to own it? Would I want to own FedEx or Home Depot or Harley Davidson? And if the answer is yes, yeah, darn shootin', I'd want to own that company. Go ahead and buy 10 shares and become part owner. That's wisdom from Mr. Warren Buffett. Wisdom from Mr. Peter Lynch. After he had done all his research, and remember, there was no internet, he would put everything for each company into a 3-ring binder. He would dutifully cut out articles and use his resources that he had at Fidelity, the vast resources of Fidelity Investments. And he would do all his research, and then he would, before he made a decision, he would hold the binder in his hand over his head. And he would give himself the 90-second story. He would say, this is Procter & Gamble. And I am buying Procter & Gamble because it is the premier consumer staples company. And it has a good long history of paying dividends. And their products are the best in the business. And people have emotional ties to them. But at the same time, their competitors are on their heels, and I'm not buying this because their competitors are on their heels, and there's pricing pressure, and they're having a hard time going international, although by now they're still stumbling internationally. But anyway, he would give himself the 90-second pep talk about why he's buying it, holding it, or selling it. And then he'd make his decision. So either one of those, you know, think about those when you make your decision, because you're always going to be second-guessing yourself, folks. You're always going to be wondering whether you bought the right stock. And you got to get used to that. You have to get used to that. You can't beat yourself up. You're going to make mistakes. Think about the person who walks into the batter's box. If he or she gets a hit 3 times out of 10 times, He's going to make a lot of money, and he's successful. But you're going to do better than that. If you use these techniques to point yourself in the direction of the stocks that have done well over the long term and will do well, should do well, not always, you know, some of them are going to go bankrupt, like Kodak, like Enron, you're going to pick more winners than losers, more long-term prudent winners. In my humble opinion, and some of you, I hope all of you, become the next Warren Buffetts. How's that? Huh? That's my goal for you. That's my wish for you. And hopefully, more than it becoming financially successful, I hope it becomes emotionally and rewarding and becomes a hobby that gives you pleasure. And if it don't, there's always mutual funds, folks. So, in review, we have started off realizing that our task is not an easy one, and we've looked at various models and found that, yeah, it was Procter & Gamble, right? No, it wasn't Pfizer, it was Procter & Gamble. And we found that there are techniques that can help tilt the odds in our favor. Cool. So now our next series of presentations will be about ratio analysis, projecting cash flows and earnings, which in my humble opinion are not as powerful as the models we've learned in this chapter, but are important to know, especially because Mr. Benjamin Graham, Mr. Warren Buffett's teacher, used them extensively. And who am I to argue with Benjamin Graham? Be awesome, dear students. We want you to succeed. We want you to be the best stock pickers the world has ever seen.